streaming live around the world. This is Paper Cuts with Brad and Jay.
We'll just get this out of the way here. Thanks for joining us on Brad's show.
Yeah, thanks for coming to my show. I did not say shenanigans. Okay.
Are you drinking already?
No, I've just got water. Just got water. Always looking smooth, aren't you?
Yeah, I do it. I try to clean up for the show. Look, one of us has to. Come on.
Well, crikey. Tonight's guest is writer Mark Taus.
We are live.
I somehow guarantee this episode's going to have like the most sunlight of any of our episodes ever. I'll explain about that in a second. What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of Paper Cuts. I'm Jay. Over there is Brad. Brad, is this our 1 year anniversary show? I think it is.
Oh, it's our anniversary, Jay. Isn't that cute?
Sweet as that. 1 year. Our first show with the one and only Megan Lucas was June 4th, I want to say. And yes. I'm really bad with, you know, dates and
you remember this memory. Show, but not the wedding anniversary date, right?
Dude, my wife might be watching, so let's not talk about that.
We'll not talk about that.
Yeah, I'm horrible. I have my memory. I'm old. But anyways, it was in June, right? But I think we did that teaser show around the 19th or 20th of May.
Episode zero.
Yeah, that's what we're calling it, right? And yeah, so how many episodes? What episode is this? 30?
30. So we had episode zero, 30 okay. Normal episodes.
So it'll be 31.
Party with Paper Cuts, so 32.
Is it 32?
Yeah.
So that's not too bad in a year's time, because when we created this, we kind of said, you know, this is not you're going to be a weekly thing or five times a week or anything like that. You know, we're both pretty busy. I have two very active kids. You have 23, I think.
23 kids. Yeah. And 23 and a half.
There's a half one.
There's a half one. He's really little. He counts.
I was gonna say that's a horror story in itself. So what better way to celebrate our 1 year anniversary than to go on a trip? We're going to trip. You know, we've interviewed people here in the US, different mm-hmm. time zones. We've interviewed people in the UK, different time zones. We've interviewed people in Canada. Mm-hmm. But this may be the farthest that we've ever traveled.
Like it's already Saturday for our guests.
Australia. Yes. The sun is in process of going down here for us in the US, and it just came up there for our guest in Australia tonight. How awesome is that? I mean, look, I got the sun shining in the back. You see the mess behind me. The sun is bright in Australia right now. This is the most sunlight we've had. We normally do this at night, and it is nighttime for us, but weird stuff. Anyways, let's get to it. Tonight's special guest, the writer of several novellas and short stories. We have Nana with the creepy-ass cover. Okay. We have Hope Wharf with a new cover. We'll talk about that in a second. Crows, I believe you're reading that right now, right, Brad?
Yeah, I finished it yesterday, I think.
One Last Shindig and Nature's Perfume. I'm not sure if that's referring to Flashwoods or not, but he is an Englishman living in Australia. Everyone, please welcome to the show, Mark Taus. Are we saying your last name right to begin with?
Yeah, that's perfect, Joe. Absolutely perfect. Now, I've had all sorts, to be fair. I've had Toosie, I've had Toulouse, I've had it all, mate. But Taus is spot on.
Okay.
How are you doing today, Mark? That.
Yeah.
It's good to be here, guys. I appreciate the invite as well.
Yes, it is a pleasure for you to be here. We know that. Thanks so much.
We appreciate you getting up early in the morning to exactly. Come join us late at night.
It's 10 o'clock now, and I've had my beauty sleep, as you can see. So,
let's start with this, because it seems like, you know, if I was to look up your name online or look up your books on Amazon or you know, see your bio, I mean, it starts out an Englishman living in Australia. How did that come to be? Are you not originally from Australia? Where
no, I'm originally a Yorkshire man, so I was born in Yorkshire, where puddings come from. But you know, I sort of outgrew UK a little bit, just in terms of specifically where I'm living. And we had the perfect route, because Steph's mum, my wife's mum, was already living in Australia, so we came across on a subclass visa. So a subclass visa where you have to have a certain amount of points before you right. can get in. And so having the mother-in-law in here just took us to that extra, just took us over the line. So like for once it was kind of beneficial, you know, to to have that sort of, you know, mother-in-law route. I keep forgetting this is going out to people. So we took that, yeah. And we haven't looked back since. So we've been here 16 years now and we love it. And compared to where I used to live in Hull, it's paradise. You know, we've got the beach about 500 yards away. It's just beautiful.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So was it a culture shock first moving there at all?
No, nothing's different really, to be honest with you. I mean, they drive on the same side of the road, speak the same lingo, you know, give or take. It was a pretty easy transition, to be honest.
So, I mean, there's a reason to move. You have family there, and it wasn't like spur of the moment, hey, you know what, let's just move to Australia.
Well, it kind of was at the same time, because I left my family back in the UK, but it was just, we just wanted to, I don't know, we sort of got itchy feet, and you know, you only get one go around, so we just thought, you know, we'll give it a shot and see what happens. I mean, like, you get a lot of pommies, as they're called, that go and have a try and then go back to England after it not working out, but we just sort of, yeah. I mean, there's nothing not to like here. It's perfect.
Is there a big writing community you know of in Australia? Because the UK, we know a lot of writers in the UK, and it's kind of congested. Now you moved away and you're someplace else. Are you starting a new community there for writing? Do you know other writers in Australia? Is it Alan Baxter?
Alan Baxter's from Australia somewhere.
The other one, I know. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, I don't know too many others, to be fair, which is downright shameful, really. But I think in terms of horror, I think horror in Australia is yet to find its place. I mean, the US and the UK, there's a big appetite for it, but Australians seem a little bit more adverse to horror. I'm not too sure why, or maybe I've not found the right community, but there definitely seems to be less of an appetite for it across here.
I think what's his name? Zachary Ashford is from Australia too.
When
the Cicada Stopped Singing and a few other books.
Yeah. Yeah, I spoke to Zach a few times actually. Like I think we're keen nature lovers and stuff. And yeah, so the nature across here is beautiful, man. It's like every day I wake up, there's lorikeets in the garden, and you know, you go for a run down the rail trail, you see a few little brown snakes and whatnot. It's just a different lifestyle. It's just really cool. It's that the novelty still hasn't worn off for me, to be honest.
It sounds like just a peaceful state of mind. I mean,
it is. Yeah, it is. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's sort of got that less claustrophobic feeling.
Yeah.
That Britain had, you know, even from the houses, they're more spaced apart. So you feel like you're not living with your next door neighbor. And you don't get to see them hanging there, washing out with a cigarette dangling from their mouths and whatnot. So it's just, we love it here.
You keep selling it like that. My wife and I would be, my family would be your neighbors, because my wife would be like, hey, let's move to this paradise of Australia here.
No, the whole family loves it. It's great for the kids as well. So
had you ever visited before y'all moved, or just you took the plunge and just moved on down there?
No. Nice. My wife had, but I've never been before. But like I kind of live life by the seat of my pants. I'll try anything once, to be honest with you. I mean, I'm not fussy, but yeah, I'm up for anything. I mean, like I say, it's one life, that the clock's always ticking. So you know, give it a shot. Why not?
Are you you and your wife big travelers, or you're staying put now? You're not.
No,
we're back to the UK much or anywhere else, or.
Well, we need to go back to the UK, because I've only been back twice in the 16 years, which is again. Not cool. So yeah, my parents are getting on a bit, so I have to sort something out pretty quickly. But Australia is such a vast place, and there's so many places to explore. Holiday wise, there's not really any need to you know, break away from that. I mean, unless you want a specifically sort of cultural focused holiday, but it's got everything you need. It's just a beautiful, relaxed place, and yeah, I get a lot of inspiration for my stories here as well. So
this just in, my youngest daughter told my wife that she's willing to live in Australia just from your description. So I guess
she just texted you.
She just totally said, Piper said she'll live in Australia. So I guess, you know, after this show,
we're pack your bags, up. Jay.
Just join the mosquito repellent, as well as the muscle spray, Jay. Pack the muscle.
I'll join. Yeah, really, the muscle spray. Got to have that. Definitely.
Gotta have the monster sprite. Yeah.
I'll join the writing community in Australia. So let's hop into your writing, because another part of your bio, you do mention that, you know, you got into it kind of late. Yeah. Was it 45?
Yeah.
So there's still hope for me yet, guys. So what happened to make you finally start? I mean, was it always in the back of your mind thinking about doing it, or just by chance you read somebody's story and you're like, you know, I could do better than that, and you wrote it? What finally got you into this situation?
It's a culmination of a lot of things, to be honest with you, but I was working in sales, and I was traveling around Asia, and I was working long hours, and I was drinking a bottle of wine every night just to sort of bring myself down, just to sort of numb myself. And I think it was, you know, along with that came a little bit of the sort of dark cloud where, you know, is this all there is? And so I know I needed something else. And the way I used to escape the cloud was to run. I used to run everywhere. I used to run marathons and all sorts of stuff. But I did my leg in a few years ago, and that sort of put an end to that. So I needed something else. And as you said, the writing was always there, like a nagging thought, something my English teacher once said, you know, if you really focus, this is something that you could really excel in. So that was always there.
So you did some when you were younger in class.
Yeah, not since you know what you call high school. Right. I mean, 30 years without doing anything creative, literally nothing creative. No. Just going to work, drinking, watching crappy TV, and what that was basically it. So I thought, you know, there's got to be more to this. So I just sat down one day with some encouragement from my wife Steph. She said, you know, just give it a shot. And immediately it was just the best therapy. You know, I prescribe it to all my friends. It's just amazing therapy. It's like you get all that bile out. But it's such a, and it takes you back to being a child as well. You know, that awe and wonder as you're writing these stories and you're losing yourself in these epic adventures. And it is just the feeling you get afterwards. It literally feels like you've had 3 hours of professional therapy. You just feel,
it's a release for you.
It is a total release, and it's much healthier than, you know, the booze. so
that's a t-shirt slogan right there.
Writing something in the booze.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't think anything of it. I didn't think my writing would ever see light of day, but I just decided to send a story out called Hugh's Friend one day, which was a little flash fiction piece, and somebody picked it up, you know, paid me $75 for it. And it was like, oh, wow, okay. This is something that I'm actually enjoying doing, but someone's willing to pay me for it. Uh-huh. You know, so that just kind of happened from there on, really.
So how was that, sending out that first story? Was it nerve-wracking? Did you, like you said, you didn't think it was going to go anywhere? You're just waiting by your phone, and it happens.
Yeah, I just let it all out, and that's what I try and do in all of my stories. I mean, obviously, in terms of story structure and the technical aspects, you have to keep an eye on that. But right. I just try and every time I sit at the keyboard ready to write a story, I try and take myself back to that initial one. All the feelings are raw, you know. So I'm not trying to sort of make it too rigid. I'm just trying to keep it free flowing as possible. It's odd. It's such a bizarre thing, and you just lose yourself, and nothing else matters. It's all your troubles, all your worries, everything is just put aside. It's great. It's a beautiful experience. And like I said, I've tried to get, you know, my dad to write. I've tried to get other people to write, just for the sake of experiencing that as well.
So why horror? Why start writing horror instead of sci-fi or fantasy or
space erotica,
nonfiction or whatever? Space erotica, Jay's favorite genre.
Hey, Jay, I could write some of that for you if you were desperate, like. But there you go. Why horror? That's a good question. I think
Have you just always been a horror fan?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I think it's the lack of limitations around it, Brad, as well. Because, you know, you can still incorporate love. You can still incorporate comedy. You can still incorporate, you know, all that kind of stuff into a horror story. So, you know, you can have a multitude of genres going into horror. But I grew up reading Stephen King and James Herbert and all the usual suspects. You know, again, just an aspect of losing myself as a way of dealing with sort of trauma, you know, is, you know, everyone experiences trauma as a child. And so I think having that escape is just, you know, just it's crucial for everyone. I just think it's such a good thing that people should be doing. It's, you know, yeah.
And how long have you been
writing? Horror stories lack of limitations, I think.
Yeah. I feel like horror is like the most versatile genre because you can mix it with anything. Yeah. You can do horror fantasy or comedy or romance or whatever it is.
Which I've tried a lot of yours. Stories.
Sorry, Jay.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, Nana and Last Shindig.
Yeah.
You did mix comedy in with those two. So,
yeah. Yeah, that's quite important for me, the comedy. Because it's not escapism if it's too dark, it feels too heavy. So it has to have some another thread running through it. But comedy for me, I've always been a bit of a clown, like probably more of an introverted clown. But there's nothing pleases me more than sitting at the keyboard just writing comedy horror. The guilty laughs and all that kind of jazz. I just love it. I think it's such a great experience. And thinking, you know, what the readers are going to be thinking about this, and you know, wincing and grimacing and laughing, and it's like it just fills me with joy.
And, you know, that's a genre I'm surprised there's not more of. Like I automatically think of Jeff Strand.
Yeah,
he just won a Stoker.
Recently,
but he was probably like the first like smaller comedy horror that I read a couple years ago, and I have probably 10 of his books I need to get into. But yeah, that's why I think of like when I read Nana and Last Shindig. It's like, you know, this is kind of in that same category, so that's pretty cool.
It is. Look, and you can't, I mean, there aren't too many sort of horror comedies movies that you can think of that really work, so I think it's not an easy genre to write. And I think you have to have a natural flair for being a clown, you know, but like Shaun of the Dead is, you know, something that springs to mind. But I think a lot of people argue that it can't be scary if it's funny. But I disagree with that. I think it can be more so because, you know, I've said before, in terms of taking the floor away, you can take people on this high with the comedy and then just rip the floor away. And that sort of, you know, roller coaster emotions sometimes is quite impactful.
Well, I mean, there are some, if you want to talk about like horror comedies, you go back to Abbott Costello, Meet Frankenstein, and things like, you know, those early shows and movies like that were kind of the foundation of mixing a little bit of horror and comedy together.
It was, but it was definitely more through dialogue, I think, than sort of slapstick and visual. And I think that's the thing. It's like, you know, you mentioned before in terms of the sort of chaotic zingers on One Last Shindig, but you know, it's a great platform for comedy, the dialogue, because I mean, you know, you've seen everything on movies and stuff, but it's that that personal exchange between people, different energies bouncing off each other, that I love about that sort of claustrophobic environment of the community center or the coach. You know, I just love that aspect, and some of my favorite books have sort of duplicated that environment. You know, through sharp dialogue. I just love the zingers. I love the one-liners, and I love the dad jokes, Jay. You know, simple as that. I'm sorry.
I always enjoy it when and I know I've said this, I'm a sucker for this. I've said this a lot of times in a lot of my reviews, when the dialogue tells the actual story. You don't need a whole lot of narrative to go along with it. You know, if you allow the dialogue to tell everything, you know, it just has a different kind of flow to it. And I could pick up on that a lot of times in a lot of books I read, and I can appreciate that because you're just letting the characters, it's almost more like a movie because the dialogue is moving.
You're showing, not telling.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Absolutely. It's a great platform to do that. And it's not just about the story itself. It's about the journey of the characters as well. And I find that quite fascinating. And you can do a lot of that through the dialogue as well. In terms of the sort of subtle connotations in terms of how people react to each other at the end of the story as opposed to the beginning of the story and how they've changed throughout that journey. So I love that aspect of it too.
And just like the word choice with the dialogue, like you can say one word that just changes the whole scene to make it funny as opposed to some slapstick, you know, joke or something like that.
Absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely right. It's, I think it akin to sort of getting or what I'm trying to do is to have the readers sort of teetering on the edge without going full slapstick, and then incorporating the scurs and so forth. So
slapstick's not going to make you go over the top some, and then it's going to enter that cheesy area, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's like sometimes in a horror story where you get all the visuals, you get all the full gore at the beginning of the book, and it's like it's sort of raised expectations, and then, you know, towards the end it's very difficult to sort of maintain that. So I think that subtle slow buildup of comedy that has readers teetering on the edge does work for me.
I think Scream is a good representative of that, the Scream movie, because it's not necessarily a horror comedy, but it has a lot of comedy elements in it. That makes it funny while it's still being scary at the same time. It's not like you said Shaun of the Dead.
It's very meta with itself. So
like Shaun of the Dead and what is it, like Zombieland, they're more of the comedy side with horror mixed in instead of the other way around, horror with bits of comedy mixed in.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. There has to be a good story to go alongside with the comedy. Otherwise, it doesn't work. But hopefully that's what I'm trying to do. So.
I was saying Crows, there wasn't much comedy in Crows. That one was pretty dark.
It was.
That's what you were telling me. You were telling me that was a little different than the others.
Crows. It is. Dark. It's a very different experience. Yeah, but I couldn't just write stories like that. That's why I have to sort of throw. I had to write a couple of comedic short stories after that one, Brad, just to sort of alleviate the darkness a little bit. Yeah, but it is quite dark.
Was Crows harder for you to write than some of your other ones that have more comedy in them?
Yeah, look, I think there are a few bits of comedy in there, and you'll notice that's where I get to the point where I have to throw this in. I have to try and lighten it up a little bit. The old lady in the shop, for example. Yeah. But if I didn't punctuate the darkness with that kind of light, then it would just be too heavy. I do feel it after writing something like that, as opposed to writing something like Nana and One Last Shindig, which is just, you know, that sort of tongue in cheek, kind of approach. Yeah.
Glowworms.
glowworms.
So with you only writing for a handful of years, how long did it take you to get comfortable with your style, and have you seen your style change over the last couple of years? Do you do anything totally different now that you didn't do or you did do different when you first started?
Good question. It's a difficult one to answer because it's sort of just, I hate the word organic, but it is. It's just practice. And you just find yourself changing the more you write. And I was going through, I haven't done any new writing this month, purposefully going back to my old stories, the ones that I think are worthy, and revamping them and putting some new life into those. And it's quite amazing to see, because you don't feel it at the time. But when you look back at some of those old stories and you sort of wince and think, oh, I missed a trick there, or, you know. So the style definitely changes. It's still me. It's still my personality getting through to the stories. But I think from a technical point of view, you're constantly improving. And I've only been doing it 3 years. Right. And I've got a long way to go. I'm not nowhere near the pinnacle yet. I'll keep on going, but without losing that original rawness that I talked about before from the first story I wrote, that personality, making sure that flows through without trying to tick too many, you know, boxes in terms of what the story should do. Or I haven't taken any writing classes. I haven't done any writing groups or anything like that for that purpose. That's probably maybe shooting myself in the foot. Maybe I will do one day, but for the time being, I just like to keep it raw and unpredictable as well, and without having the story structure already in place in terms of the first line and the end line, always see the pants, because that's where I get most enjoyment from it. I don't know what's going on, you know, and I want to go on a journey too. I don't want it to be
I enjoy that, just letting it go where it goes. Yeah. You know, and yeah, you can always tell that someone's had a little bit more fun that way, you know. It's not so structured every step by step by step. So.
Yeah. Some people write like that and it works for them, but for me, it has to be fun. I have to have fun. I have to have my guilty giggle at the keyboard. You know, I have to put people through trauma, and, you know, having them not knowing what's happening from one page to the next is cool. I like that. And they're my favorite type of books as well. There's one, for example, called The Ballad of Lee Cotton by Christopher Wilson. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've come across that one.
I've heard of it. I've seen it. I've not.
Yeah. And that's the kind of story I like, because it's got that sharp dialogue, but it's got that unpredictability around it. You don't know what's happening from one page to the next. And that's my favorite kind of book. You know, sometimes you can pick up a book and think, read the first chapter and know exactly what's going to happen. And it can still be entertaining. But I'd much prefer to pick up something where I think, oh, Christ, I don't know where this is going. No idea where this is going.
So that blows me. I don't feel like my brain works that way. Like if I were to write something, I would have to know where it's going. I don't feel like I could organically just, I don't know where it's going. I'm going to follow along with the characters and stuff like that. That
works for some people.
That just blows my mind. Like I don't think that way. I have to have like at least like an endpoint or somewhere to go to. I feel like I wouldn't be able to just make it all up along the way.
Look, I think if I ever had the balls to approach a novel, I think that would be a different story because you'd have to plot out the subplots and whatnot. I couldn't wing it for 400 pages. I wouldn't put the readers through that. But for a novella or for a short story, I can just about get away with it, I think.
Yeah, because
novellas are the longest you've written so far.
Yeah, I think the longest piece I've written was about 35,000 words. Yeah. I don't know. I'm in love with a novella, though. I'm a big, big fan.
I think the horror community is in love with the novella. I mean, as far as like the smaller independent and self-pub community, I think they're in love with the novella. So
yeah,
I think it's
getting a bit of a Sorry, Brad.
That's okay. Tor Nightfire, they're putting out some novellas, and they're a bigger publisher, so they're doing some smaller stuff. Like Nothing with Black and Teeth was one, and they've got a new one by T. Kingfisher. I can't think what it's called. But hers is like a novella. It's like 190 pages or something.
I saw that on
that
gallery.
It's got like the grotesque rabbit on the front. It's a really cool cover.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Can't be the grotesque rabbit.
But yeah, we say it all the time.
I watched actually was about killer rabbits. I can't remember what they called it. There's an alternative version of Watership Down, but it scared the hell out of me. They all had like these vampire teeth and they were out in the wild and just sort of like picking on tourists. I can't remember what they call that. But sorry.
Watership Down is a good book. Yeah. It's like a kid's book, but it's not a kid's book at all.
Yeah.
It's kind of scary.
It is. Yeah, killer rabbits.
But we see it all. The novella is like the 90-minute horror movie. Like right. It's the perfect length, most part, it for is. A horror thing.
It's great for readers these days because we're all busy. And, you know, a two-hour sit-down session is something that a lot of people can stomach. But, you know, a book these days, I mean, it's really got to be a direct hit for me to carry on throughout the entire journey. I mean, I've picked up quite a few recently from authors that I used to read, you know, digest as a kid, but I don't know what it is because of the distractions, because of everything else going on there. It's much more difficult to just commit, you know, your time to something that, you know, isn't, you know,
I don't have the attention, and like I basically have the whole Stephen King library, but I don't have the attention span to read some of these 1200 page books,
and
my mind would start wandering. But then you have like a novella, and then with yours where you allow the dialogue to tell a lot of the story, so it's going to go quicker, so it's a much quicker novella. That's more my attention span. I'm going to forget I said this 5 minutes from now, and when I rewatch this tomorrow and put it on my channel, I'm going to be like, oh yeah, I did say that, didn't I? So
that's it.
Something could be just old age too, but still.
Yeah,
like I love a big, you know, thick Stephen King book, but there's something so rewarding about reading a novella in one sitting and just having the whole story done, consuming it. You remember everything because you read it all at one time. You don't, I read 300 pages a week ago and maybe have to backtrack a little, remember what was going on, all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
And we're in the age of technology now. Everyone's attention span's so short, and everything's instantaneous. Really, you know, everything dumps on Netflix all at once, and you know, you can look anything up at the drop of a hat. And so people's attention spans aren't as long as what they used to be.
In 30 seconds, a 30-second TikTok.
Yeah, 30-second, 60-second TikToks. And
you're pressing your luck with that, definitely.
Yeah, I know. It's taken me so many years to get my boy to actually pick up a book and read. He's 17 and he's just got into reading. It's just insane. You know, I was reading on my bed like when I was 10 years old, just like digesting King and stuff. But I'm so glad he's finally found it. But I think he's beginning to appreciate the benefits of reading as opposed to just that quick fix kind of you know, punchy nonsense, superficial crap. But he's really into this book at the moment. So
I'm trying to get mine to relook, and they do. My oldest is 13 and she's been reading some stuff from school, and my youngest is 8 and she's making her way through the Goosebumps stuff. And I never read Goosebumps. I was too old for Goosebumps when it came out, so this was my chance to, you know, do little reviews with her. So as long as she's reading something, I'm totally fine.
I don't care what they read. You're absolutely right. As long as they're reading something.
So I wasn't a big reader growing up. Like I got back into it like last maybe 3 or 4 years is when I started really getting into it again. So
okay, all right. Yeah.
So were you a reader as a kid?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I memories sort of flash back to just lying on my bed, just letting the summer breeze sort of come through the window and hearing all the other kids having water fights and stuff and laughing and screaming. But for me, you know, losing myself in a book was much more fun. It was magic world, and you couldn't compete with that. Uh-huh.
So
how would you,
go ahead, Jay.
I was just going to say, now that you have a handful of novellas out and you've been doing it for a few years and you have numerous short stories out, how do you feel about the overall reaction to your style and to your books? Would you say they're a success? Do you ever look at reviews and you know, take those in? I mean, are you seeing people and are leaning towards a certain book more than the others? Just your overall feel for your body of work so far. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, good question, actually. People love Nana. I mean, it's like, it's an odd thing because that was my
debut. And I dropped the ball. I'll be the first to admit, because like you must have sent it to me probably, 9-10 months ago. I don't even remember. Yeah. And I sat on it for a while. I just didn't get to it. But then I was like, why didn't I get this to this earlier? So
is that a Don Noble cover? Did he do that one?
It is indeed. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I didn't even really tell him. I mean, he just came up with that just like magic. Honestly, he just knows exactly what's in my head. And it couldn't be any better, that book. It couldn't, the retro colors, the slime, you know, it just couldn't be any better. It was perfect, absolutely perfect.
I think that
probably helped as well.
I love when a cover artist has a distinct style. Like, you can just tell that person's cover, like Don Noble or Justin T. Coons or, you know, all these people. Yeah, I think that adds to the books too. Great cover. Oh, yeah. Like they say, you know, don't judge a book by its cover, but I totally judge a book by its cover. Like, if it has a garbage cover, the chances of me reading it are going to go way down. And it could be a fantastic book, but I might never know.
I know. Absolutely right. But you look at that cover and you think of, you smell baking and you smell, you know, sort of cigarettes and stuff. And it just sort of like conjures everything that is what the book is about, really. And it was a big risk, Nana, because that was my first one. And I thought, you know, how the hell are people going to react to this? I mean, I'd written a few short stories, but nothing of that length. And I was thinking, this is nuts. What are people going to think of me? But and it does push the boundaries, you know, at certain points. And I think that's sort of like hit a few people's raw nerves. And that's come through in a few of the reviews. But generally, it's been received incredibly well. And, you know, I think there is a big appetite for horror comedy out there. And a lot of people have said to me, you know what, Mark, this was a great way of getting me back into reading, because, you know, I think I've been reading a lot of heavy stuff. And this is a little bit lighter, a little bit more tongue-in-cheek. So I think
it's a palate cleanser.
A little bit of a bridge. Yeah, absolutely. So Nana is definitely the most popular. And one last Shindig is early days, but the reception from that is pretty good so far. There is a third in the old folk horror comedy coming out called Generation Games next year. That'll be my final.
I was going to ask that here in a minute, but go ahead.
Absolutely. And that's, if you thought the other two were crazy, this one is absolutely bonkers. But, you know, I mean, I'll just keep, Crows has received really well. That's getting really good reviews. Hope Wharf is getting really good reviews. But as an indie author, I think it's just getting the awareness out there. We all know the battle. It's just like, you know,
somebody fish in the sea.
You know, a lot of people say they love my writing style, but it's just getting other people to experience it. And the only way you can do that is through, you know, sort of self-promotion and, you know, sending a book for free reviews and whatnot, and just hoping the word spreads. It's,
I think with Nana, I automatically, reading the dialogue, I just had that voice of an old woman who smoked too much. So she had that, really, you know, like she's still smoking. That voice,
the rattle in the back of the throat, and absolutely. Yeah, the dried fizzy air from all the cigarette smoke. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So are those two books?
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, it was just, like I say, it's just that the smell almost emanates from the page of that cover. Yeah. And it just the essence of it was just, it just kind of helps sell the book. It really does. But smells is a big thing for me in terms of when I write stories. Because I think sometimes it's quite missed, but smells is like that extra, that's that other sense that I think is sometimes underutilized. And I love playing on that. I really do, in terms of that extra dimension to the environment as well. Just in a way that comedy is an extension to personality. I think that's a mistrick sometimes. So I'm trying to play on those two things quite a lot, and I keep that in my mind when I'm writing stories.
So let's make your next elderly book a scratch and sniff.
Yeah. Can you imagine Nana with a scratch and sniff cover?
Get the smell of the muscle spray coming out.
Yeah.
The muscle spray is water all over the world. Yeah.
So are those three books, Nana, One Last Shindig, and the new one, are those like your elder horror trilogy?
They are. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's not series, but it's just a similar sort of bunch of people that just go through one trauma to the next. Yeah.
Well, there you go. So I was going to ask if you were going to do a series or not. So I guess that's the answer to that one. So
do a series one day. I think I'd like to do a series. I don't think I can leave all folk horror behind, Jay, to be honest with you. It just provided so much fun for me, so much entertainment. I'll probably come back to it at some point. So I'll probably say Generation Games was the third and last, but I don't think it will be, to be honest. I think I'll dig the old buggers up and have another go.
Are those books actually connected at all, or just the sense that they're just about elders that is what connects them?
Yeah, there's just apart from a few Easter eggs that they're unconnected.
So why elder horror? What made you want to write that for?
All right. Jay's been dying to ask me that one for bloody ages, I think.
Because you don't see very many, you know, other, not just books in general about just elderly people.
No. I think people are missing a trick because it's, look, I'm 48 now and I'm starting to get aches and pains and whatnot. And I'm, you know, Steph has me orange juice with me 60 vitamin tablets ready for me every morning. And it's like, but in my head, I'm still 12. I'm still jumping off the shed roof doing commando rolls. You know, I mean, I'm just, you know what I mean. It's the legs and everything else that can't keep up with the mind. So it's that perceived divide. You know, I think that the initial idea came from I was doing my a paper round for my boy. So he just got a job as a paper boy, and I was going on a round with him. This is first round. I thought, I'll come along for the ride and just, you know, help him out because he was a bit nervous. And we were given this sort of semi-retired estate. It was, you know, those freaky places, all the sort of gargoyles and stuff like that, all the black cats around and these little sort of statues of little boys holding their willies and stuff, like fountains and stuff. And it was all freaky stuff, you know. I remember it being sort of really overcast as well, which added to the sort of ominous feeling. And there was this old man that came out. No hair on his head apart from these two eyebrows that just met like caterpillars in the middle. And he came across to my son and he said, he started talking to him at my son's face. He just like, he looked at me like help dad, you know, what do I do? You know, this frigging alien's coming. I don't know what to do. And it was that divide, you know what I mean? That perceived divide, that the alienation that my son felt for this other human being that had lived a life, that had been a child once, that had been through everything he'd been through. And I just really, that just sort of started the cogs rolling in terms of, I need to write about this. And yeah, the rest kind of flowed really. We're all kids, you know, regardless of how old our body is, you know, regardless of my fucking legs feel like dust these days. but we're all kids. We're every day. We're sort of like, you know, we get excited about things. We still look at the stars and the moon with awe and wonder. We just so I just wanted to really emphasize that, but take it up a notch, you know, to the nth degree, really. Yeah,
it's like a different spin on taking a real life situation and turning it into a little bit of a horror. So yeah.
Oh, look, I mean, you couldn't really say it was a dedication to old people because there are some gruesome. Horrible stuff.
True. I mean, it kind of made you come off like, you know, you're trying to wipe the world out of these the old people out of the world. So
yeah definitely no, so it couldn't be an ode to old people. You definitely wouldn't call it that, but look, it was just so much fun to write, and that's where the idea started from. The rest just happened, really.
It's I don't know if Jay's kids, but it's always funny that younger kids, like really small, like 3-4, they always seem to be scared of older people for whatever reason. I don't know why it is. There's just something that terrifies young kids about old people.
And you go back to your childhood when, because I never really saw my granddad much, but you know, now and again, I'd be dropped off just like because my parents wanted, and I dropped off with this stranger every morning, you know, it do.
Maybe not scared, but maybe uncomfortable is a better word.
Uncomfortable. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But everything was different. All the smells are different. Everything, everything is different. You know, every time I used to get there, he used to give me like a flat can of Coke and like a Mars bar. You didn't peel a Mars bar and you find chocolate. It's supposed to be brown. It was just white. It had this white coating on. It's like, is this safe to eat? I don't know if this is safe. How long has it been there? You know, but everything is odd. And, you know, the way you used to make porridge in the morning, you could literally just stand your spoon in it.
like a brick.
Yeah, like a brick.
I think I mentioned the, I don't even know what brand they were, but they were raisin cookies, raisin oatmeal cookies. Is what. Yeah. And I haven't had them since my grandmother died. I was like 16, I think, when she died. So I haven't had them since, but she always had the, and it was some off generic brand, but these were these oatmeal raisin cookies. That's what I remember the most. And I never got them at home. It was always at my grandmother's house. So that's just, nobody else ever had them.
Yeah.
My grandmother always had cinnamon candy, and it was just in a red wrapper. There was no name on it. There was no nutritional value, just these little red.
And you don't know what year she bought those. I mean,
no, they could have been 30 years before.
Like I said, the Coke is always flat. So I just wonder, I thought it'd be 1965, just keeping them for special occasions. That never happened. Crazy. But it's a lot of fun. And like I say, it's just like, we're all the same. We're all kids. We just want to laugh. We just want to laugh like we do, you know, like we used to in the school playground. You know, when you can't stop laughing, when you got tears falling through your eyes, and you go around again, you keep going. I just, you know, that for me, the pursuit of that is quite key, because I am just, I don't take life too seriously. I'm just looking for laughs, and yeah.
And like you said, that's kind of
much to my wife's distress. But
yeah. Like you said, that's kind of an untapped area. Like having your main group of characters be elderly people, because you don't. Not just horror, but like I said, you don't really see that in anywhere, any type of fiction, really.
No, I mean, you've got, I suppose, movies like The Visit, which is a cool movie, which again sort of explored that.
Was that the M. Night Shyamalan?
Yeah.
That fell apart. I'm sorry, that just fell apart.
Enjoy that one?
No, like it's
Jay's a tough movie critic.
I am. For the most of it, I was like, okay, this is not bad.
Yeah.
And it just, something just fell apart with
that. What part of that? What part?
The whole wrap up, maybe? The whole
the wrap up, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I was just like, okay.
Yeah.
Usually, if there's a movie that everyone loves, Jay hates it. That's usually how that goes. Like 99% of the population will love this movie, and Jay's like, I hate it.
I should start doing movie reviews again. I haven't done
you should.
For a long time. I reckon definitely the alternative one. Get all the most popular ones, and we'll have Jay's opinion on it.
Yeah. He hates all the popular movies.
Next.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
No, but you're right. You don't see it. You don't see it. It's. I know I read. There's one that came out the same time of mine called Malinay by Josh Lushberg, and that was a really good book. That was another fun exploration by D&T again of old age and senility and everything that goes with it. You know, you've got the recent Anthony Hopkins one as well, which explores that aspect of losing, you know, losing missing pieces and stuff. And I remember my dad had an episode a few years back, and he had this. It's called transglobal amnesia. I don't know if you've ever heard of that or come across it. But it's scary, because they were going on holiday the next day, and they had all their suitcases packed the night before, ready to go. And he came downstairs and he said to his wife, he says, "What are these for? What's happening?" You know, and he had no idea that they were going on holiday. And she had to sit down and explain to him, so that they had to cancel the holiday. And he had this episode called transglobal amnesia, where you sort of lose short-term memory. So everything within the last 48, 72 hours or even longer is gone. And you just can't remember things. So it's scary. Old age is terrifying, man.
That is terrifying.
Things like that. It's like the possibility that at any point you could lose a fragment of your life. You could lose some part of the story. It's, it's frightening.
Really very frightening. Terrifying, but it also sounds familiar to me.
But you recognize it.
I may use that. Yeah.
You recognize it. Yeah, you do.
Tyler Jones.
And you think, oh no, I've just said some of that sounds exactly like what my dad would say. And it's like, oh my goodness, man, take me away now. Yeah.
Tyler Jones has a book called The Dark Side of the Room that deals with like a dementia and stuff like that. And that's really scary stuff, because you know that's the real, that's the real horror that it could happen to people.
Yeah, it is. It is definitely. Yeah. But I think horror does give you the opportunity to explore something like that. But add, that's one thing, right? But I mean, sort of add a sort of comedic element to it. I mean, it's, you know, you couldn't do that probably with other genres as much, but I think you have to find the light in everything. I think that's important for me. You have to look for the silver lining. You know, I mean, it's not always that easy, but yeah. So this is why I started writing. This is why I fell upon it. It's, for me, writing is just therapy.
So I've only read Crows so far, so I might be wrong, but it feels like you tend to lean towards more like the real life horror, like the human violence on violence and stuff like that. Is that fair to say?
Generally, yeah. Most of my short stories, and I've written 150 of those to date, have definitely been more psychological. 150.
I have two. I have a couple. I have like these.
Yeah. So you've been writing for like 3 years and you've put out that much work?
Good therapy, Brad.
That's crazy. What can I say?
It feels like I'm catching up for lost time. Honestly, I found something I love doing. All of a sudden, it's like it's all I want to be doing. It's an obsession now. It's an addiction.
So you have what?
Bad addiction.
You have what? 4 or 5 novellas and 150 short stories or so?
I think I've got about 7 novellas now, and nice. At least 150 stories on the spreadsheet. Yeah, some I haven't sent out yet. Some are still waiting for the right call and whatnot. I've gone back to loads of my other stories that were published in the first year that I'm not happy with, and I've gone back and revamped them, and you know, looking to potentially get those done as reprints and stuff. So it's an ongoing journey. I mean, you're always improving, and as long as I'm having fun, I'll be doing it, you know, until my dying breath, for sure.
I'm thinking Old Times was actually the first one. It was in the half GC from Dark Ink, edited by my friend Rebecca Rowland there.
Rebecca,
But I think Old Times was the first short story of yours I read. I think I read Nana before. I had the Gen X from Dark Ink, but I think I read Nana before your story in this one. But
yeah.
So I mean, with all of these short stories and in your novellas, I mean, which one is there a particular one you prefer over the other, or you just do it depending on whatever story is?
No, I don't really prefer. I don't really prefer one over the other, to be honest with you. I think like Brad said before, most of them are definitely like lent towards psychological rather than sort of full blown cryptids or whatnot. But I have done a few of those as well. I prefer, like I said, I prefer stories with dialogue. And I have got quite a few stories in the pipeline or finished stories about old people again. I don't know what it is. I'm just drawn to it.
You need to copyright Elder Horror.
Definitely.
As far as length, though, I mean, do you prefer writing short stories as opposed to novellas or vice versa? Does it even matter?
I prefer short stories, purely because there's something I can immerse myself within for 2 or 3 days and I'm done. That's finished. Novellas for me are a challenge because I don't get much time. All the novellas I wrote were during lockdown, every single one. I haven't written anything longer than 6,000 words since we came out of lockdown. Mm-hmm. Just because for me, I really struggle with dipping in and out. Like I have to lose myself. I have to immerse myself in that world for big chunks, like 8-hour chunks. Hats off to anyone that can write a novel, like spend an hour a day after work and just, you know, it's sort of that accumulation. I'd really struggle with dipping in and out of those worlds like that, because it takes me a good hour or so to get back into the story, to get back into the rhythm. Mm-hmm. So I do prefer short stories. For that reason, just for sanity, really.
I don't even know if this is a thing, but that sounds sort of like method acting. Are you sort of like method writing? You just get into the character, into that world and their headspace and everything?
Yeah, look, I generally don't write for calls for that reason, because I just try and keep as much rigidity out of my writing as possible. Mm-hmm. I'll generally write based on an idea, based on a painting I've seen, based on a dialogue I've had with a client, or based on, you know, just anything that sort of springs to mind. So I'll take that idea, and like I said, I won't have any idea where it's going. I'll just run with it, and at the end of it, fortunately, there always seems to be like there's only twice I've given up, you know, where it hasn't worked, where it hasn't gelled. But I always seem to find my way to the finishing posts. Short stories, they're perfection for me. Anything around 3,000, 4,000 words, yeah.
If you have so many short stories and and it sounds like you have some ready to go,
yeah.
Why wait for a call? Why not do a short story collection?
Good question.
Not putting you on the spot. I'm just saying because
no, I'm always
not putting you on the spot, but I'm putting you on the spot.
But why?
Tell me I'm quite why. Happy to be candid, to be honest with you, that kind of stuff. But to be honest with you, short story collections are hard to sell.
Yep.
You speak to any author about it. Short story collections are a real pain in the bum. You know, anthologies are different because it's a bit of like, you know, a box of chocolates. But short story collections are a really, really hard sell. And I think you have to have quite a huge following for that to happen. If you sell a short story at a semi-professional, professional rate, you can earn, you know, a lot of cash from it. You know, more so than you can do, you know, some of my novellas that have been out there. You know, you can take $500 from a story and,
You know, they're offering like 8 cents, 10 cents a word. I get that. Yeah. I get the financial part of it. You know,
yeah.
I mean, if you're in for it for the money, I'm joking.
I'm not, but
I'm totally joking. Yeah. I was just curious.
I'm definitely not in it for the money, put it that way. But it's also nice to sort of, I suppose, have something appreciated. And I suppose it's that imposter syndrome. If someone is willing to pay you for a story, then it's that gratification. And I think that's part of the addiction of coming back and writing stories as well.
I mean, you just totally crushed me because I've been working on this short story collection for probably over a year now. And so now I'm like,
no one's going to run a read.
And two of the stories are stories I got rejections on. So
no, but I am putting out a short story collection. I can do the same now. like I say, sometimes you just, the call comes and it's just perfect. And it's like, oh, you know what I mean? It's like, it's just a direct hit. And I wait for that. And I get excited about it. You know, there's a few calls at the moment that I've sent stories to, and I'm constantly checking my email. So I think it's that little bit of excitement as well. Like, yeah. It feels like Christmas. Like, oh, will they accept it? So I think there's that living life by the edge kind of thing is kind of exciting too.
You should drive yourself mad if you're like checking your emails nonstop. And was that my phone ringing? Are they calling me now? Or, you know, it's just...
I exaggerate a little bit, but you know what I mean? It's sort of that little novelty aspect. It's like, oh, you know, and it's going back to the feeling I got when I saw my first story. You know, someone paid me $75 for it. It might as well have been a frigging million. You know, I mean, from my point of view, it was like, oh, wow, this is brilliant. You know, I mean, I've someone's willing to pay me for the crap that's coming out. unfortunately, like when I'm doing the public speaking, I get really nervous, but I don't have that luxury of editing what comes out of my mouth. That's too late. Right. You know, plenty of situations Steph will vouch for from that point of view. But I forgot what the question was. You see?
There might not have been a question in there. I don't know. you crushed my dreams. Now I'm just scrapping my whole short story collection is scrapped now.
No, I don't know. I mean, it's like I said, I've got one coming out next year. It's just... but I like to hold on to them for that novelty feeling as well.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask real quick. You mentioned earlier you brought up D&T. How many books do you have through D&T? Have you always had all of your novellas with publishers, or have you done any self-pub yourself?
No.
That doesn't make sense, did it? Self-pub yourself.
No, I've never self-published. I've only really been through D&T, World, Castle Publishing, and Journal Stone. For Nature's Perfume.
That's the newest one, right?
That's the newest one. Okay. Yeah. But look, I mean, like I said, I'm not really in it for the money, but D&T do a great job. They do a fantastic job. You know, it's a luxury of having Don Noble on the cover. And it's just nice to be part of that community. I love it. And Don's great to work with as well. And, you know, it's that establishing that relationship with the publisher is kind of quite key. Mm-hmm. So we've got Nana, we've got Crows, and we've got One Last Shindig with D&T.
Okay.
And we've got Nature's Perfume coming out in November this year, which is like crazy, crazy, crazy. And we've got The Generation Games coming out 2023 and a short story collection from D&T coming out 2023 too.
Okay.
Nice. How'd you get hooked up with D&T? Do they have like an open call you submitted a novella to? Or
they had an open call. Yep, absolutely. They had an open call, just much like they're doing now. I think they've got one on the go now. And I sent Nana through and Dawn loved it. And just starting from there, really, to be honest with you. I think it was this is a story that I think she liked the originality of it, and she liked the, you know. So, look, I mean, half the battle is trying to stay original in right, this game. Yeah. And that's what I always try and do. And it's very difficult, but, you know, through your own unique writing style, but also trying to throw a decent story idea that does sort of, you know, catch people off guard is tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's millions of Haunted House novels, and after a while, they all sort of start to bleed in, feel the same. So if you do something different, like sounds like what you did with Nana, you know, that grabs people's attention.
A haunted house with old people. There you go.
Generation games.
Is that what a haunted house story?
It's got a little bit of that in. Yeah, it's got a bit of an aspect of that in. So
is that done, or are you like still?
No, that's done. That's done. I can't wait for people to read that. That goes from a slow amble to just absolute insanity. Yeah, just I think that's probably my favorite. It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. Yeah. I'm not going to say anything about it, but I already know what the cover's going to look like. I already know what the cover's going to be. It's going to be great. Yeah.
Oh, I got to read the first chapter of One Last Shindig, and that starts off with a bang. The intro to that really got my attention.
Yeah, definitely. I couldn't start off with the glowworm thing, could I? I had to jazz it up a little bit, because it's like trying to sell a book about people are going to see glowworms. I mean, you're not going to be queuing up around the corner, are they? So I had to adapt something else in there as well.
And I love the like muscle spray. I mean, just those terms. It could be different a meaning for me than what it is for you. It's just, you know, the language barrier. You know, I'm thinking like Asper cream or Bengay or something, and you're saying muscle spray. I'm like, what the heck?
You know, we have this thing called, I don't know, did you get fiery, something called Fiery Jack over there?
Mm-mm.
It's like a spray that kind of burns, but it's supposed to massage you.
I mean, there's so many different ones.
It's like Icy Hot and Bengay.
All that. So
I do regret not asking for some sponsorship. I do regret. I think I've got a missed opportunity there for having some backing from someone that does muscle spray.
Like a bottle with every book.
Yeah, that would work. Absolutely, yeah. But muscle spray is, especially in my book, one spray, you can take on the bloody world, mate. but yeah, I definitely missed the trick there, I think.
Yeah.
So you said you know what the cover is going to be for the newest book coming out. Do you have a bunch of input on what the covers are going to be?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'll send an email to Don, and it'll just come up with his magic. And, you know, generally it's spot on straight away. Yeah.
Nice.
He just knows what's going on in my weird mind.
Has he done all your covers?
He hasn't done the Journal Stone one. He did. Their sidearm did that one. They've got a sidearm as well. Ironheart, I think it is. He didn't do the original Hope Wharf one, but he did the second one because I wanted to change that horrible cover. But he's done an immaculate job on the new edition. And I think he did Face the Music. That was my first short story collection, Jay, called Face the Music.
I've seen that. I've read it. I haven't gotten it.
Yeah, so that's the one with the scarecrow, with the crow on the arm and the big moon behind, which again is just an absolute stunner. I've got a full-blown picture of that on my wall, actually, which is sort of not egocentric. I just loved it so much. I just wanted a big blown-up picture of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I honestly can't imagine anyone else doing my covers, and Don Noble just knows.
They're amazing. Our buddy Brian Bowyer uses them all the time for every single one he releases, and it's just every time. Like, I think this last one is one of my favorites. What is Autumn Gothic?
Autumn Gothic.
That's beautiful.
I mean that cover is probably one of my favorites. So
yeah, it's sort of it's like Crows as well. It's just the palette. It's very simplistic, but it's sort of really in your face, and I think it works really well.
Mm-hmm. Is the new Hope Wharf cover, is that the one? I might be wrong. Is that like top down, like looking at the water, or the beach, or something like that? Yeah, that's a good look. I like the colors on that one.
I love the colors, and it's like, you know, you think when you're going to get it in paperback, it's going to be slightly obscured or fainter, but it's not. It's perfect, and it's almost, you can almost see the translucency of the water. It's the shimmer of the water. It's absolutely spot on. I was very naive going into it, and writers are impatient, mm-hmm. so. They'll take any bit of scraps. You know what I mean? So I signed up with World Castle for that one, yeah, and they put the cover together internally, but I was never very happy with it. But you know, it was. But I'm really glad I got a chance to actually go back and put a second edition, which is something I never dreamed I'd be able to do. That honestly, every part of this journey, I'm just pleasantly surprised at, and I'm just enjoying. You know, I'm like I said, I'm not in it for the money. I just love the journey. I just love the fact that.
But you just said that writers are impatient, but yet you've not done any self-pubbing. If you do everything through a publisher, yeah. You kind of have to wait, and you're on their time period. So, like, I mean, someone like me, like if I have my stuff ready, you know, if I was to land with a publisher, great, but no one's going to see it for a year. I am a yeah. very impatient person, and I'm getting older, so I don't have a lot of time, you know, left. So I'm going to be like, hey, I'm releasing it now myself, you know. So
yeah. I'm impatient and lazy. That's a leap. Yeah.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah, exactly right. It's a constant battle. Yeah.
So being with not only D&T but the other publishers you mentioned, have they been a lot of help in the process as far as, you know, spreading the word out there to potential readers and all that stuff, getting your name pushed out there, as opposed to what you think maybe you could have done if you just did self-pub stuff?
So what you've done, you basically give me all the easy questions and now you're giving me the Last Supper. Look, I mean,
like, yeah, I'll rephrase it. If someone is brand new, like Jay has a collection coming out and they're wanting to get out into the world, would you recommend someone to self-pub or would you recommend someone to go with a publisher?
I'd recommend someone to go with a publisher. I think it's just the thought that, you know, the sort of the comfort of having somebody on your side. And, okay. You know, when I first launched Nana, there's no way I could have done a good enough job on it. That dawned it. There was so much initial promotion and stuff. And, you know, she was so excited about the project. And it was so nice to have somebody else excited about it as well. And it's that sort of contagious, infectious excitement that I enjoy as being part of a team rather than doing it on my own. Yeah, I could easily self-publish. I could self-publish now. I think, you know, because I've got a very small following, but you know, I could self-publish now, and I could probably do okay on it. Because you know, for indie writers, most of the self-promotion falls on ourselves. We have to do that. We have to put our book covers out there. We have to put reviews out there. But I think it's just a bit of a comfort thing, you know, and. Look, I do feel a certain loyalty towards D&T because of such the job they did on Nana, and they're pulling in some great writers, and you know they've only just started, so I'm happy to be part, you know, sharing the journey with them.
And I feel like with the smaller presses, it's not as long of a wait time as it is with bigger ones. Because I was watching Keelan Patrick Burke on Chad Lutsky's new podcast the other day, and he said he can choose to self-pub something and put it out in the world today. Or he can send it to his agent and get it to a publisher, and that might take 6 months, and then that might take another year, and then it's going to be released 2 years because they already have all these other books on the docket. So that book you just finished today might not come out for 3 years.
Yeah.
So it's that give and take of, well, do I want to go with a publisher and, you know, have them help promote it and do all that stuff and wait longer, or I can just put it out now and people can start read it, you know, tomorrow.
Definitely. And that's the same as well, going back to the short stories as well. I could put them out now. Or I can send them to, like, you know, calls looking for a 25 book payout and stuff like that. So it's that impatience as a writer is our worst enemy sometimes. And there's been plenty of times where I've sent out multiple submissions, and I've had one come back saying, you know, yeah, we'll give you $30 and a paperback copy, and I've signed the contract. And then the day later I've had somebody else, oh, we'll give you 500 books for that or something. So it's that impatience is a killer. Yes, and it's our worst enemy probably as a writer. But the thought of waiting 3 years for something that I've written to come out, I'd have no fingernails left. I'd be a wreck, I think, to be honest.
The reason I worded it like that when I asked why don't you just do a short story collection, I was kind of thinking along the lines of you have limitations for calls, you know, 4,000 words, 5,000 words, whatever the case may be. But if you do your own, there are no limitations. Like I said, I have two part of my collection that were rejected. And those were, one's like 4,000, one's like 5,000. Okay. Mm-hmm. But now that they're rejected, I'm putting them in my own book. I could expand those to several more thousand on top of that, you know, and make it the way I really wanted it. Parts I had to cut out to fit the guidelines. So, I mean, that's just one way I'm looking at it. Well, if you have so many short stories, you know, why not release them yourself so people can see the real one as opposed to, and I totally get being part of a, you know, an anthology, because like when I look at these, I mean, there are several writers I've never read before. I use anthologies to
discover people,
discover new people. So I totally see that too. I mean, I was just kind of joking. Why don't you do your own short story? But still,
like the Tim Curran one I just read, it had, you know, short stories. And the last one was like more like a novelette. It was like 60 pages where everything else was like 15 to 20 pages. So you can have that range of one really long story, shorter stories, maybe a flash piece. I mean, the
Ronald McGilvery one, and it's like 8 or 9 short stories. And then the last one is like a 70 page novelette or something. So you can mess around with that too. So,
I've got a special collection. So I've got the ones I've designated for calls that fit that sort of criteria around 3,000, 4,000 words. And I've got another spreadsheet with all the ones that the sort of auditors, the different.
So you're organized.
I that's what I've been doing the last 3 weeks. I put an email out there to say, I'm not going to do any new writing. But what I have been doing is going behind the scenes, trying to get organized, because I've got 157 stories. And it's like, every time a call comes up, it's like, oh shit, which story do I send? It's like, have I sent that somewhere? I don't know. I can't remember.
Right.
But like I say, I'm 48. I need to get more organized, you know, because otherwise I'll just be like, yeah. So I've written
everything. Sending the same story out to everybody.
That could be a problem. Yeah.
People don't appreciate that for some reason, you know? I've had to get more organized, you know, it's a weird thing, but I'm still wet behind the ears. I've only been doing this writing game 3 years, and it's like, things like, so if you have a story accepted for a podcast, is that then considered a reprint? You know, is that, because it hasn't been out in print, but is it considered a reprint? And some people say yes, and some people say no. So it's all that kind of stuff. I've just spent my time like auditing my work. Yeah, this is what I've got to send out. This is what's going to be in the short story collection. This is what's already been published. So I'm just trying to get on top of things, really.
So what is it like to submit do you submit stories like No Sleep Podcast? You've had some of yours on there.
Yeah.
So is it the same sort of like an open call? Like they call for stories and then they produce them, I guess, right?
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. So it's like, I think once you've had one or two with them, it becomes easier. Because you've got that relationship with them, they know the style of writing you've got, they recognize your name. So it becomes easier every time. For me, it took a long time to get into No Sleep. I remember through Olivia White, who's part of the team that runs it, you know, she gave me some really good feedback the first time I sent something across, because I'd had a relationship with her before through another publication or from one of her friends that runs something. And feedback is anything, you know, from my, that's why I sometimes like sending out short stories, Jay, because if it doesn't work for them, you do get some good feedback. Not so much these days, because there's, you know, people get inundated with stuff, but
just sucks. I'm kidding.
Look, it's hard. Rejections suck, man. They suck. They really do. I mean, it is, because it's like you wake up the morning before you even brush your teeth, there's a rejection in your email. It's like, oh, for fuck's sake. And it's like, you know, and you don't get a good feeling for the day. But then if you get a you know, an acceptance, it's like, yeah, you've got a springy step. It's madness, man. You know, it's like, you know, you can't go out and buy the Ferrari or anything, but it still feels good. It gives you a good feeling.
So with like the short stories you do for the podcast, do you have to like format them differently where it's more like a script since it's this ensemble cast that reads them, or is it just the same as you would, you know, to any type of paper or anthology?
Just the same as I would, really. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think the one I used to submit to called The Grey Rooms, I think they're after more sort of script-based sort of play type formats. But again, if I had to adhere to a certain format, I would struggle. The less rigidity, the better.
And with those, I guess, do they have the same thing? Like they're looking for Western stories or clown stories or whatever. Or are they just more broad with what they're looking for?
Very open. So I think the way they work, I mean, I might be wrong on this one, is they collate all the stories, and then based on what they think are good, they'll put together a little theme and run that theme, for example. So I think the one they had on Mother's Day recently, So I think they accept first and then figure out what can be the thread, for example. Or maybe they do allocate certain spots for certain themes they have in mind as well. But they don't specify any particular sort of type of story on submission process.
Do you have any clown stories ready to go?
I don't. I've never written. I'm not.
That's weird.
That just popped in my head. I don't know why.
Right, he's the clown stories, and you have some comedy in your stories, but you have there no you clown go. Stories ready to go.
Missing a trick again, man.
You need an old person dressed up as a clown as your comedy horror story. There you go.
You know what? Why not? Yeah. All right. I'll put that down on the spreadsheet.
Since we got you sweating now with some of these questions, let's relax a little bit. Let's just go ahead and hop into a game. Your reading, so you all calm right. down a little bit. Unless the game gets you all excited, I mean, but
I'm easily excited.
Okay, so we'll play some Australian horror. Jay will play along too, and he'll just completely butcher everything. Right. I'm pretty sure
that wasn't too bad.
That was bad because I didn't voice it over. That's why.
Yeah,
you hate my voiceovers. So we'll play some trivia here. All right, let me see. And again, these are just simple questions. So I say simple.
You say that, Brad. You say that, then, Brad.
I get them wrong.
Why do I get the feeling I've just had my Last Supper? Honestly, look, I'm from Yorkshire. Can we just clarify? I'm from Yorkshire. Where Tut Puddings come from? I've been in Australia 16 years. So please, just
we'll take it easy.
Go easy on me, yeah.
All right. So first up. What is the highest grossing Australian movie?
Movie or horror movie? Just a movie.
Just movie in general.
Oh, my goodness me.
It's comedy. I'll give you that. It's comedy movie. Yeah.
Are you saying it was made in Australia or it took place in Australia?
It just says highest grossing Australian movie, so I don't know. I think it was probably made in Australia, too.
Oh.
It definitely takes place in Australia. It might be made there as well.
I don't know. If it was horror, I'd go Wolf Creek, but
Jay's Googling. Look at him. He's cheating already. Look at Jay.
Let's see what we got going on here.
Jay.
I have my suspicions.
It's a very stereotypical main character.
It's not the guy that fixed toilets, is it?
No.
What was that?
It turned into a series.
There is a movie about a guy that fixes toilets.
Is that Ernest?
Ernest P. Worrell.
Ernest fixes your toilet?
He's kind of like an Ernest kind of character.
He has a big knife.
Big knife. That's not a knife. This is a knife.
Did you hear him? Yeah.
Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah.
It's only going to get worse, isn't it?
I think that's the only one I even could think of, to be honest.
And you Googled it anyway, Jay. You just see JJ was like...
All right, I won't Google anything else. I'll use Yahoo.
All right.
Put your phone away. Put it on the desk behind.
All right, next up. What is a jumbuck? I don't even know if I'm saying that right. J-U-M-B-U-C-K. What is a jumbuck?
That's a truck, isn't it?
It's an animal.
What kind of animal?
I'm going to take your glasses off because I don't deserve to wear glasses. I don't deserve to look intelligent.
It's a four-legged animal.
So it's not a kangaroo?
It's not a kangaroo.
Oh, God.
What is a jumbuck?
Next. Jumbuck, I don't know.
Is that a dog? Or a wolf or something? Or
it's like a farm animal.
Is horse? It? A lot like a llama-type creature?
Kind of llama-ish. A little bit smaller. Getting closer. Alpaca? No. They're getting closer.
Sheep? Is it?
So why couldn't they just say sheep?
Well, I don't
what
know.
Part of the country do they?
They're Australian.
Where do you get these questions, Brad?
Australian duck. I'm jumbuck.
Jumbuck. Australian for sheep.
Australian for sheep.
Jumbuck. Australia for sheep.
All right. Are there more? Are there more kangaroos or humans in Australia? You got 50-50 chance here.
I think I got kangaroos on that one.
More kangaroos in Australia than humans.
Are there really? Mm-hmm. Wow. It is a gang, right? In a group of kangaroos, a gang?
I don't know. A group of them, are they called a gang? I'm not sure.
Or maybe I'm thinking of
a gang of kangaroos?
I don't know.
We should ask Alan Baxter. He knows because he wrote the Killer Kangaroo book. I bet he knows.
He should know that. Yeah.
All right. What, Jay, don't go off script. That's what you said with this joke. What does Australia have the longest of? It's just right up Jay's alley. Just pitching it to him. What does Australians have the longest of?
What do Australians have the longest of? What does Australia have the longest of?
What does Australia have the longest of?
Oh, that's different.
Yeah, that's a different question.
Oh, Jesus.
It has to do with sports.
Huh?
All right, so right, number one.
I'm confused with the question. That's what she said.
The longest one. Sports. The longest one.
It would be a type of course, like field course.
Obstacle course?
Sports-wise, like professional sports, what would it be?
Football pitch?
Obstacle courses are professional sports?
No, Jay.
Ironman. The Ironman thing.
They have the world's longest golf course.
Dude, we are failing. This is our one-year anniversary show. No, it's going to end. This is the end of it.
This is how all the games are, Jay. They just... <I know. laughs> But it makes people laugh, so that's all that matters.
All right.
How many of the world's top 25 deadliest snakes live in Australia?
Ooh.
And it was funny earlier because you were talking about going outside and see the snakes on the sidewalk or whatever.
Yeah.
How many of the top 25?
Yeah, live in Australia.
So we have like a 1 in 25 chance just saying a number and getting it, right?
There you go.
An educated guess, Jay.
17. What are you going to go with?
I'm going to go with 14.
Higher.
Is it?
It is.
20?
21.
So I was 21. Closer.
Yeah,
I would have won on a game show.
21 out of the world's top 25 deadliest snakes. So Australia, just they have crazy animals there, right? They just everything kill you, basically.
That's definitely like a fact. Honestly, that's a weird thing because that's what I expected. I expected like, you know, spiders, you know, the size of cars. I expected like crocodiles on every corner wearing sunglasses, reading newspapers, ready to jump out and snap your own. No, but I mean, I've only seen probably about 20 snakes since I've been here. Plenty of kangaroos.
That's 20 too many for me.
We don't get any alligators or crocodiles in Victoria. They're Northern Territory. But no, it's really not that bad. I mean, we do get some big spiders, some right juicy ones. But
The actor who plays Thor, he took a picture in his house of a spider, and it was literally like this big in his kid's bedroom.
Yeah. Probably a huntsman, was it? Was that a huntsman?
I think it was huntsman or wolf spider or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we get some big ones. There was one on the roof of our car, actually, the interior roof. We didn't see him, so it must have been at the back and it must have been crawling along.
Where was this conversation earlier when my wife decided we were moving there?
Yeah, Jay's not going to Australia anymore.
She's not going to go for snakes and giant spiders and all that stuff now, so...
Yeah.
So how big was the spider in your car that you didn't know was there?
It was about the size of a big hand, the size of a giant's hand.
Like, I'm not even scared of spiders, but no, I don't want that in my car.
Trying to catch it in a glass was definitely a challenge, put it that way. Yeah, even in a pint glass, it was a tough job.
It was a mega pint glass.
Yeah.
All right. We'll do a few more. Why is the emu and the kangaroo depicted on Australia's coat of arms? Why are those two animals on the Australian coat of arms?
Yeah, I should know this. And you know what? That question was actually on the entrance.
Was it really?
Australia. Yeah. But I have.
Because they're cute? I don't know.
Because they can't walk backwards, so they're always going forward.
That's it. Yep.
So was that really on the entrance exam?
It is. It was indeed. Absolutely. Yep.
That's a weird question to have on that.
It is, isn't it?
What was the answer?
Because
they can't walk backwards.
They can't walk backwards.
So...
so they don't want to... Australians, they don't want to retreat, so it's... It's on their coat of arms.
I think the golf course question wasn't so bad, was it, compared to that one?
That's like the American flag on the military. It's always, sometimes it looks backwards because it's always facing forward, though. It's always going forward. It doesn't retreat.
Somebody just said, I'm not going to say who. But somebody just said that you should be deported. No,
who said that?
She's going to kill me now.
Is that your wife?
No.
They're probably right. I probably should be deployed, actually. Yeah, it's pretty shocking, to be honest with you. I am quite embarrassed. But how many more questions are there, Brad, by the way?
We'll finish with this one. I'll give you a multiple choice.
She's going to kill me in a second. When this...
Which of these famous actors was not born in Australia? Was it Margot Robbie, Hugh Jackman, Phoebe Tonkin, or Russell Crowe? Who was not born in Australia?
I don't think I've heard of that third one. Who's that?
I don't know. I'm going to have some really obscure and go Russell Crowe.
Russell Crowe's correct.
Yeah. Where was he born? Was it New Zealand or something?
Yeah, New Zealand. So
yeah,
close enough, but not quite.
So is that the first correct answer?
First correct answer. We'll end it on a good note, right?
Yeah, let's do it. Sorry, Chad. Commiserations.
Sorry, you got one more than Jay, so that's always a win.
I lost track how many I got, so we'll just move on.
Which is great.
You didn't get any, Jay.
I did. I got something. I got
you got.
You got the snake. That doesn't count. And you got Crocodile Dundee because you looked it up on your bloody phone.
Yeah.
But there's another one after that too. So okay. What do you have to read to us tonight, Mark?
All right, so I'm just going to read a really quick paragraph from One Last Shindig because I get nervous doing stuff like this. I'm not a natural. I'm definitely an introvert. It does genuinely stem back from this. My fear of public speaking and whatnot.
You can picture us naked if that helps. I mean,
that's not going to help him at all, Jay.
Absolutely,
it's going to make his eyes melt out of his head.
That's just making me think of another shrimp on the Barbie. That one, Mark. It was, you know, when you have to do that talk at school, you have to get up and talk about 5 minutes about anything, about something in particular.
I hated that.
Yeah. Man, honestly. And
what a way to traumatize a kid, right?
It's so traumatizing. And I remember for days I was thinking about it. Like, even doing this, like for a couple of days, I was getting nervous about it. It's weird.
Really?
I don't know what it is. Yeah, look, it's daft because impromptu.
No, I get that.
We've had guests those before were super nervous and stuff before they came on.
Right.
But hopefully it's more, laid back and comfortable. And
no,
by
it
the end
is.
Of it,
it's
hopefully great. You've had fun and you're not, a nervous wreck by the end of it.
No, not at all. But like I said, the fear stems from where we had to choose something. For some reason, I chose to talk 5 minutes about my goldfish called Fred. And to this day, I don't know why I chose the bloody goldfish. I really don't know. And I remember just getting up there and, like, when everyone's, you get all the eyes burning on you and stuff. And I just remember, like, just trying to get some words out, when the throat feels dry and everything. And I'll forever take back those eyes on me. I remember just opening my mouth and closing it. I think some people thought it was part of the act, like I was moving. I just, from that moment, I was always terrified of public speaking. It's really odd. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. I hate public speaking. And, like, I do these videos and stuff all the time, but I've gotten better about it, but I hated listening to my own voice. So I'd go back to edit the video. It's like I have to listen to myself talk for 15 minutes. It's like, this is awful. This is torturing myself.
I mean, not to, showboat, but I mean.
Oh, yeah. Jay.
I worked in radio for like 10 years. So, I mean, so
you got a face for radio, though.
Yeah. Yeah. I got a face for radio, but this people can see me. So I got to watch my expressions.
Yeah. Fair enough.
All right, story time.
I'll just keep this very short because this isn't my thing, right, guys? So,
long as short as you want, man.
Yeah, all right. I say, driver, how long until we see the worms? Not long for you, pal, if you keep shouting. It's a skinny little fucker with the curled up lip, Eric Hansen. He knows the name because he put a black mark against it as soon as the wiry little shit opened his mouth. A little over an hour, I imagine. Can you put your foot down? We're all ticking time bombs, are you? For that one, Patrick decides he'll stay up all night filling in forms and then some. Elle had even offered to help dig the hole. He turns Dolly up, hoping it's the last he hears from any of them. Good whiskey that, wasn't it? Patricia says, bearing gums that don't quite fit. Saw you knocking it back, Eric. I thought you were going to wrestle that guy to the ground when he took the bottle away. He wouldn't have done that when I was in my prime, I can tell you. He flexes an arm, wincing as something crunches inside. Good drop, though. Aye. Patricia nods. You'd look a lot better with contacts instead of those glasses, Eric. I only use them for reading, but thanks for the unsolicited advice, Greta Garbo. He leans forward, tapping the shoulder of the woman in front. Liz, I say, Liz, how's your George? Looked a bit worse than were on his way back to the coach. It's Liv, by the way. Aye, he's sleeping it off. What was that business with him stealing that old coot's walking stick and pretending he was back in the trenches? Got me with fucking friendly fire. Liv offers a deep sigh. Afraid he's more nut than fruit these days, has been for a while. The drink doesn't help. Used to all the room with his stories, but he's only got a couple of marbles left and loses them sometimes. Eric's in his element now, centre stage and taking control. What about you, Joyce and Patricia? You married or still playing the field? He sizes them up, taking in the sheer width of their arms and legs and how their arses spill over the seat. Breasts that could suffocate a man. Big as bowling balls and enough cheap perfume to sink the Titanic all over again, he thinks. Yeah, I don't anymore. See, I get nervous. It's really weird. It's odd. I can't.
No, that
can't,
was, you know. That was good,
that,
man.
That first conversation on the bus early in the book, like I was just laughing out loud with it because I was picturing, you know, the guy's going, huh? I can't hear you. And everyone's speaking up a lot louder than what they need to. And I'm just picturing this bus driver. He's just so pissed off that he got this assignment or whatever. And he's just thinking, God,
yeah. It's just memories. I mean, because, you know, we weren't particularly wealthy as a family. So we'd often go on these package holidays to Torquay and down south. And it just takes you back to that claustrophobic environment, you know, the heat of the engine, the banter of the old people, the sarcasm and everything else, the elbows in the side, our Jeffrey, you know, all that kind of stuff is like, it's very nostalgic for me. And so it becomes very easy to write. And all I'm doing is, you know, immersing myself back in that world and then just trying to reignite those conversations and what happened.
And there's always like a wise ass that's the loudest. he's like the shit stirrer. He's the one that's saying, you know, stuff, trying to, you know,
rally everybody up.
Raise your blood pressure a little bit. And
he loves the banter and he wants the drama. He wants, absolutely. Yeah.
Right.
That's Eric Hansen in this story. Yeah.
That was a good little excerpt, though, because, like you said, it gives you people a good taste if they haven't read your stuff of the banter with the dialogue. And Jay was talking about it feels like you tell the stories through your dialogue more so than, you know, just plot points and stuff like that. And that's a good example of that.
Yeah.
And you get the comedy in there mixed in and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully. Yeah.
I want to talk about Crows for a minute. Because it seems like that one's quite different than your other stuff. And it feels like kind of folklorish in a way.
The depressing part of the program is brought to us by Brad.
The depressing part. Yeah. We'll end it on a low note, right?
Yeah.
So it sort of felt like Wicker Man in a way, and I haven't seen the movie, but kind of Midsummer-ish in a way, like Cult and that kind of stuff. Where did that idea for that book come from? Was there something specific or just something about the crows themselves that you wanted to turn into a story? Or
That's a difficult one to answer. Someone's asked me that before, and it's very difficult to trace back the origin of a story when you're a panster, because it's like...
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You don't already have it in mind. But I've always, you know, had some respect for crows. I always, you know, give them attached a high importance to them. Mm-hmm. You know, the way they sort of look at you from their branches up high, and, you know, they're almost judging you. Like,
they're very judgmental. I was going to say that.
yeah. They can see into your soul, and like you feel as though they can... For me, it feels as though they can see every misdemeanor, every flaw in my character, and they sort of judge it. But the fact that they're so intelligent as well, you know, the fact that they monitor traffic lights before they go and swoop down on cadavers, and you know, it's such an intelligent creature, and I think that's part of it. But I've always been fascinated with cults too. Mm-hmm. You know, I've loved, you know, things like The Ritual and by Adam Neville and whatnot. So I think I just wanted to meld the two together somehow, and that Crows was the final product of that. Really, it was fun to write, but it was pretty dark. Yeah,
and I don't want to give too much away, but the cult sort of aspect was totally not something I saw coming. Like the way the book started out and where we ended up, you know, giving them going to a Halloween party, that was not where I thought the story was going to go. But it was a very pleasant surprise, as what it turned out to be.
Yeah, it's. Yeah, it was fun to meld the two different creatures together, sort of thing. I can't say too much about it, but it was fun to explore that, but maintain the spirituality and all that kind of things as part of the cult's beliefs and whatnot. But yeah, mm-hmm. No, it was an interesting adventure, that one.
Did you do a bunch of research, like for just kind of cult ideology or anything like that for that, or do you not do much research for your books? Or
no, I honestly don't. I'll go through it at the end when I go through the editing process and just make sure I'm not doing anything too out of line. Uh-huh. It's an interesting one actually, because the original cover for Crows had a dream catcher on. And you know, again, it's not something I think of at the time because I'm just lost in these worlds, but then I had to sort of, like, you know, somebody said, well, that's not really reflective of, you know, there's a certain culture, and it could be, you know, deemed as being disrespectful. So I had to remove the dream catcher from that. But
So you changed the cover.
I had to change the cover because, okay. Yeah, there's all sorts of, but like, a fair point. You know, I just didn't think of that. But that, like I say, yeah. With any of my stories, you know, my intention is never to upset or, you know, disturb people. I just want to take people on a fun ride. And Crows, like I said, just organically grew from that idea of having the crow relentlessly tapping at the window of this person, you know, trying to get a message across. And I just wanted to, you know, I didn't want to give away too much at the beginning. I wanted to let the reader think, oh, what does the crow want? You know, where is this going to take us? So the guy ends up following the crow, and then the sort of adventure just takes off from there. So, it was definitely a panster type story, but I'm really pleased with the way it turned out, for sure.
And I can't remember for sure. I don't think it mentioned like a specific location at all, like a certain city name or anything, did it? I know it said that you used to live in the city.
Yeah.
Are all your stories sort of setting agnostic, where they could be, because this was like in the forest and their whole area
and Hope Wharf. So
is that a real place?
Hope Wharf is the idea is like to be as like a little quiet seaside town in Britain.
Yeah.
You know, but I never give it a name because I think that takes away some of the magic, isn't it? It's like,
I'm about halfway through it right now. I'm getting a little bit of a Stephen King mist feel. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I know you mentioned King earlier. I don't know if he was an influence on your current writing, but that's what I was.
Yeah, definitely. There is a touch of that, but I mean, it's a very small part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not quite halfway. I'm sure it's going to change directions a little bit, but yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. but look, I mean, like I said, I have no idea where these books are going, and that keeps me coming back for more. I don't have a clue. But I think, you know, I figure if I don't know, then the reader's not going to know. They're not going to have a bloody clue. So, you know, from that point of view, that keeps me going. That gives me a buzz.
And with it sort of being, at least that one, sort of setting agnostic, like it was rural and they're in the woods. Like for me, I was picturing it being Australia because you're the author, you're Australian, but it could have been in America or the UK. And
yeah,
with it being where it could be anywhere, that is more likely to maybe connect with a reader. Well, maybe it's where I live and they can picture, you know, the woods in their backyard or whatever it may be and fall into the story more, get more connected with it that way. Instead of saying it's in Chicago or, you know, the UK, London or whatever it may be.
Definitely the idea. Because like I say, I don't want to, that sort of magic aspect of this place that exists, but nobody knows where it is. I want to sort of maintain that. I don't want people to have too many attachments to it. I want them to go in with an open mind and not have this fixed idea of a certain place, really.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mark, it's probably getting close to lunchtime for you.
I was trying to discreetly send a message to my son to bring in the charger because my laptop's going to die in 10 minutes, and I was getting real nervous. And I was like, oh, no.
It is Saturday. We don't want you to waste any more time with us or your rest of your Saturday. I'm sure you got things to do. And
no, it's been fun. I enjoyed it, mate. I enjoyed it very much.
Thanks so much again for stopping by. I know you're on social media. Where can people find you? Instagram, Twitter, all your fun stuff there.
Yeah, so Instagram is Towsey Writes, Towsey Writes. Twitter is Mark Towsey 12, so Mark Towsey with a Y in the end, 12. Facebook, I'm very easy to be found. I'm, you know, I'm quite open to interacting, talking horror, and having a laugh. Yeah, so it's pretty easy to find me. All my books are on Amazon.
So there were 11 other Mark Towsies on Twitter already. You had to get number 12.
I had to get number 12, yeah. No, I just took a shunt actually on that one, to be fair. Like, but there is another Mark Tows on there, that, you know, because it's quite an odd name. It's quite, you know, so I'm always surprised to see, you know, that name pop up now and again. But, yeah.
And one last shindig, that's your most recent release, right, with DNT Publishing out now?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a good ride. I promise people a lot of fun on that one. The crew is fantastic. It'll keep you good company. Plenty of weather. There's originals.
Little worms.
To go around. Yep.
Yeah. And there's a cool fight scene too. Yep. So we can't thank you enough for stopping by. I totally appreciate it, because we're just two dopes with microphones. You know, and sorry, it's exciting when we get somebody come in and chat just about all this stuff. So totally appreciate it.
Especially from the other side of the world. That's pretty
cool. I mean, this
getting to connect with people
in the future.
Yeah, we never would be able to talk about this without, you know, this streaming kind of thing. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah, absolutely. Nice. It's perfect time for me. This is perfect. Yeah.
I mean, I wish you could tell us the winning lottery tickets
from the future.
I've never heard that one before, Jay. I've never heard that one before.
Thanks, everyone. I know.
You had to get
you,
a dad joke.
You said full of dad jokes. I had a quota.
Yeah, I know. There you go.
I had a quota there for us.
You had to slip one in at the end.
Big thanks to everyone in the chat for stopping by as usual. This will stay up on Brad's channel tomorrow. At some point, I'll put up on my channel. We'll turn this into a podcast for those of you who don't want to see your faces. You rather, you know, listen to it. Spotify, Apple, all that stuff. You know, that'll be sometime tomorrow afternoon. So, but that's it. It's been a year that we've been doing this, and I've not shut down the show yet, which is kind of scary. but everyone in the chat, totally appreciate it. And everyone's going to listen to this later. Thanks a lot for our special guest tonight, Mark Tows. That's a wrap, everyone. I'm glad you had to see me.
Thanks a lot. Pleasure. Loved it.
Nice to talk to you, man. Love you, Jay.
Bye-bye.